Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC, and a lot of people are saying the hope and change Barack Obama has given way to the partisan warrior Barack Obama. But maybe the more political Obama is the more focused on hope and change. Listen to this from yesterday's inaugural address.
For we, the people, understand that our country cannot succeed when a shrinking few do very well and a growing many barely make it. We believe that America's prosperity must rest upon the broad shoulders of a rising middle class. We know that America thrives when every person can find independence and pride in their work, when the wages of honest labor liberate families from the brink of hardship. We are true to our creed when a little girl born into the bleakest poverty knows that she has the same chance to succeed as anybody else because she is an American, she is free, and she is equal, not just in the eyes of God, but also in our own.
We'll hear more excerpts from the inaugural coming up, and we welcome back to the show Chicago Tribune syndicated columnist Clarence Page, who was with us yesterday from the Washington Mall. Hi, Clarence. Thanks for coming back on.
I'm delighted to be back and inside and warm.
And listeners, what did you think of the speech? Your reaction to President Obama's second inaugural address, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or post to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. And I want to play one more clip from the inaugural. And then, Clarence, I want to know if the whole thing was surprising to you. Here's the president on government programs and how the Romney ticket portrayed almost half the country as takers, though he doesn't mention Romney or Ryan by name.
We recognize that no matter how responsibly we live our lives, any one of us, at any time, may face a job loss or a sudden illness or a home swept away in a terrible storm. The commitments we make to each other through Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security, these things do not sap our initiative, they strengthen us. They do not make us a nation of takers, they free us to take the risks that make this country great.
So he didn't mention Romney or Ryan by name, as I said, but he might as well have by referring to their description of makers versus takers in the economy, implying the 47% right there in the inaugural address. So, Clarence Page, how surprised were you by the tone or substance of this speech?
Well, I was surprised that it was it came across as liberal progressive, as he did. And I'd remind myself, oh, yes, he is a liberal progressive. And I thought that at first, this isn't exactly, you know, reaching hands out to bridge troubled waters, but it is a firm declaration of where he stands in relationship to where his political opponents stand. This speech sounded a lot like a campaign speech, but I reminded myself that this campaign was a very clear debate between right and left, which is what Americans need. We need to have a clear debate on these issues, foreign and domestic. While some might say that he was rubbing Romney and Ryan's noses in it, especially some of my Republican readers who think we should not talk about that election campaign at all of a sudden. On the other hand, we are in the midst of this debate. You know, I was trying to compare his speech to the greatest second inaugural, Abraham Lincoln's, binding the nation's wounds. And but Lincoln's war was ending at that point. It was almost over officially. Obama's war, if you want to call it a war, or it's really a debate, is only beginning over how do we deal with the finances of this country versus the needs of its people over the next few years.
And maybe this is just the hard-won experience of his first term on how to get to yes and to compromise. I mean, it would be nice to try to govern by consensus, let's all get around the table in a room together, Democrats and Republicans, and not debate, but just form, you know, solutions that are good for everybody. But in real-world negotiations, you often get to yes more effectively by starting with your negotiating position, arguing passionately for it, and compromising from there. And I think history tells us that that's what Ronald Reagan did, even though he has a reputation today as having made a lot of deals with Tip O'Neill and the Democratic Congress. What do you think?
No, you're absolutely right. And Obama was criticized from the left repeatedly in his first 4 years for giving away too much in negotiations with the opposition. I think that that period is over, judging by his tone yesterday. And also, he is aware that the Republicans, the more reasonable Republicans, do want to sit down and reason together, particularly John Boehner. Boehner has had trouble from his right with his own Tea Party right, who have rejected the grand bargain that he struck with President Obama and other deals along the way. His biggest stumbling block has been on his own political right, and the Republican Party has its own civil war inside, where they're trying to get back on the reasonable and correct track that can win elections. And I think President Obama is not taking advantage of that, but being very clear in the midst of all that as to where he stands.
And maybe he is taking advantage of it. I think this was just consistent with the tone that he's taken ever since the election. Remember in the fiscal cliff negotiations, even in those last days of it, where he was trying to get the Republican House to yes on some things, he was very publicly rubbing their noses a bit in how they sometimes switch up their deals at the last minute. So I think he's decided that there's more to gain by rubbing their noses in it at this moment than not. And there were specific policy items that he brought up that surprised some people for how specific he was willing to get on contentious issues. And here's an example of that.
We will respond to the threat of climate change, knowing that the failure to do so would betray our children and future generations. Some may still deny the overwhelming judgment of science, but none can avoid the devastating impact of raging fires and crippling drought and more powerful storms. The path towards sustainable energy sources will be long and sometimes difficult. But America cannot resist this transition. We must lead it.
Another clip, and we've got a couple more to go from the inaugural address. Brian Lehrer with Chicago Tribune syndicated columnist Clarence Page, and you at 212-433-WNYC. And Diane in the East Village, you're on the air. Hi, Diane.
Hi.
What'd you think?
I thought it was great. It's what I wanted to see. I think Barack Obama came dangerously close to being Jimmy Carter, too, trying to change Washington. Nobody changes Washington. I think he's more realistic now and may be able to get some more stuff done. He got a lot of stuff done the first 4 years, but there's a lot of things that the middle class and America needs for him to accomplish to go forward.
Diane, thank you. Cass in Newark, maybe not as thrilled. Hi, Cass, you're on the air.
Yeah, I'm not so thrilled. I'm a Republican. I guess you could say conservative, but I'm not like, you know, a lot of them. I voted for Obama the first time, but I didn't vote for Obama or Romney this last election. I've mostly only heard, you know, the excerpts that you've played, and I guess I'm kind of pessimistic. I used to be more idealistic. I used to really believe all these things that the president said, but when was the last time Obama really spoke for himself? When was the last time he wrote his own speech? So I always take now what he says with a grain of salt, knowing that, you know, 99.9% of the time he didn't write it or have anything to do with what he's saying.
You mean because he's got speechwriters?
Yes.
Well, they all have speechwriters, and presumably...
I know, but, I mean, well, did Abraham Lincoln, you mentioned before, did he have a speechwriter?
Did he, Clarence?
I don't think. I don't think Abraham Lincoln. When was the last time we had a president that didn't write, I mean, that did write his own speeches?
Mm-hmm. Obama writes his own speeches.
Does he?
Yes. You know, David Axelrod, I've known since he was an intern at the Tribune, and we've talked about this. While other speechwriters made the first draft on some of the more routine speeches like this, his acceptance speech and others, he gets the first crack at it and the last, and is also writing right up to the last minute quite often.
And, Cass, you know,
then I guess I'm more frustrated.
Because this is really...
That he did write it. Because, you know, I believed in him the first term. I believed in him, and I don't think that he delivered half of what he said that he would, and now he's just making more promises.
Cass, thank you very much. And I think that brings us back to what we were talking about before the last clip, Clarence, that if there is, as it appears to me anyway, that there is this conscious decision being made to rub the Republicans' noses in their failures a bit and their weaknesses as a negotiating strategy, why do they think this will work? I'll give you an example that's a different example. It was David Plouffe on one of the Sunday talk shows this week, president's political advisor, and he was referring to how the Republicans caved on the fiscal cliff deal. And some of the panelists afterwards on the roundtable noted that, and it did occur to me to think, well, what was the point? Because that was probably a conscious decision, to use that word. Why would the president's aide go on national television and say, well, the Republicans caved, if they're going to want to get more out of them in these next coming negotiations on the new rounds of the budget that'll be discussed? They must think that they're weakening the Republicans in the public eye. Do you think?
They're certainly trying to set the narrative. In each of these confrontations so far, for the most part, we have seen Republicans cave. And that is a signal to the far right in the party. But I think let's take a step back and look at the larger picture. President Obama, I think, has come to realize, along with his rest of his administration, experience has taught them that he's really only got 6 months to get something done in his second term. Because after this is the second term, he's already a lame duck. He's not running again. After the first 6 months or so, members of the House and, a third of the Senate realize they've got to get their campaigns ready for 2014. And that's the real world. It is something that this administration knows that President Obama is going to get his agenda through. Then he's got to move right now, just like he did 4 years ago in getting health care off the ground, the stimulus, other reforms that he wanted, the Ledbetter bill for the rights of female workers on the job. These things have to be done right away. And so I think that's why he just left out the economy, foreign affairs, the other issues that Republicans would like to see. He just left them out of the speech. He dealt directly with the agenda he wants to push. I think he wants to be the Martin Luther King of this era, which means beyond black folks, it means gays and women, immigration, climate change. And he put it right in the face of the climate change deniers and all the right-wing talkers and bloggers, et cetera, with a nice little neat line about how, you know, maybe you've got the sound bite, but you know, about how snarkiness can't stand in for reason. That's not forward, but that is essentially what he said.
Yes, and actually we're going to get to that sound bite after this one, which is the clip from the inaugural address that's probably getting the most attention. No president had ever mentioned gay rights in an inaugural address before, and President Obama put them squarely in the context of the American history of civil rights movements. Listen.
We, the people, declare today that the most evident of truths, that all of us are created equal, is the star that guides us still, just as it guided our forebears through Seneca Falls and Selma and Stonewall, just as it guided all those men and women, sung and unsung, who left footprints along this great mall, to hear a preacher say that we cannot walk alone, to hear a king proclaim that our individual freedom is inextricably bound to the freedom of every soul on earth.
So, Clarence, Seneca Falls to Selma to Stonewall. I think that gave a lot of women and black people and gay people chills.
There you go. You know, this is the first time that gay rights have been mentioned in an inaugural address. Everybody knows this is the 50th anniversary year of Dr. King's March on Washington. The day was Dr. King's with a celebration of Dr. King's birthday. All of these symbols came together. There was no way Barack Obama was going to be able to ignore all of that, and he just took that and embraced it and made that a guiding theme of the event. That hey, folks, we're all part of history. It's happening right now, and this is the history of the future that we're writing beginning today. You know, this is important too. Everybody talks about the confrontational tone of Obama's speech. In fact, his delivery was as smooth and upbeat and optimistic as ever. It's the words we're talking about that were very declarative, simple and straightforward, and progressive, liberal progressive. And that startles people who are accustomed to all of the weasel words that we often have in Washington politics.
Right. Russ in Princeton Junction thinks the president is not rubbing the Republicans' nose in it. Hi, Russ.
Yeah, I'm a little confused, Brian, and, you know, I'm a great admirer of your show. I don't understand why referring to climate deniers and, you know, advocating equal treatment for gays and defining,
no, that,
you know,
those
what
weren't
your administration,
the parts,
you know, is going to try to achieve is rubbing their noses in
no,
it.
No, there he's arguing his points. The rubbing their noses parts in it were the ones we discussed before, where he referred to the unpopular line that Romney got caught using, which was takers, to refer to the 47%, or his advisor going on a Sunday talk show and saying the Republicans caved on the fiscal cliff.
His advisor,
it's all coordinated.
Deliver a speech to the nation, and perhaps, you know, David Fluff. Probably was trying to respond to all the criticism, you know, from the left that Obama had been much too accommodating in the past. But in the president's speech, and even the reference to Romney's comment, also is an important ideological point that you know, that matters. That there's a difference between trying to reform entitlement programs and trying to gut them. And I'm a little, you know, it seems to me that your attitude is perhaps an example, you know, of liberals, progressives, you know, kind of leaning over backwards not to be offensive. And I don't think...
Yeah, no, I think it's... it's my political analysis of what he was doing, and you can disagree with it, and you just did, and thank you for your call, but it's just my political analysis of what it looks to me like he's doing. But here's an alternative political analysis, Clarence, and see what you think about this, that someone suggested to me. Rather than Obama having moved to the left after 4 years of centrism, maybe the center has just moved to the left after decades of shifting to the right, and Obama is just there waiting for it.
I like that, you know, because I think that there's some truth to it. We found that after Franklin Roosevelt, it took Harry Truman to secure the idea that the country had moved to the left. After Ronald Reagan, it took 4 years of George H.W. Bush to secure the idea that the country had shifted back to the right. I think now perhaps we're seeing the continuation of the Clinton years. Maybe Obama is picking up where Bill Clinton left off and securing the idea of the country not being totally to the right. I'm not going to say we're shifting back to the left ideologically in Oklahoma or Kansas or Indiana, but we are seeing the country right now is changing demographically and ideologically. And this is something that Obama was tapping into. You know, look at the election since 2000. We've seen it is the cities, the East and West Coast, Great Lakes states like Michigan, Ohio, Illinois, that have been deciding elections. And that has moved us to the left, not to the socialist left, but to the old school AFL-CIO blue-collar left. I think that's something that Obama is capitalizing on and pressing on in order to restore the keep entitlements safe and various other reforms.
In fact, true liberals could be upset, true progressives, that he took the low-hanging fruit. Nothing in there about truly ending war. In fact, they launched a drone attack on the day of the inauguration. Did you notice that?
There you go.
Or single payer or New Deal style work programs or unions or gerrymandering, which is the only reason the Republicans have a majority in the House today.
That's right.
And he didn't go to any of those places, but it's just one speech. But Liz in Glen Cove, you're on the air. Hello.
Hi, Brian. How are you?
Good, thank you.
I loved, towards the end of the speech, the call to action, where he talked about we must act knowing that our work will be imperfect and victories will be partial, and how he led into that with talking about the name-calling as reasoned debate and all of the sort of, the blocking tactics that have been going on. Mm-hmm. I feel like that gets really to the heart of what our problem is and what his challenge is and what all of our challenge is.
And being a request-driven radio show, we're going to play that clip since you asked for it, Liz and Glen Cove. Here it is.
We cannot mistake absolutism for principle or substitute spectacle for politics or treat name-calling as reasoned debate. We must act. We must act knowing that our work will be imperfect. We must act knowing that today's victories will be only partial, and that it will be up to those who stand here in 4 years and 40 years and 400 years hence to advance the timeless spirit once conferred to us in a spare Philadelphia hall.
All right, Clarence Page, last question. Did you hear Beyonce bring it on the Star Spangled Banner?
I certainly did. My wife certainly did too. It was truly a great moment for her. And disparaging Kelly Clarkson. It was excellent performance too. But Beyonce just. I don't know. I think she was going after Aretha Franklin's title.
That's just what I was going to say, that I've always been partial to the Aretha Franklin version. Was that your favorite, too?
We're talking about all-time favorites.
All-time favorites, Star Spangled Banner, absolutely.
Marvin Gaye at the New York Knicks back in the 70s. He did a slow, sultry version of it to a bump, bump, bump jazz beat, a remarkably slow beat that it brought complaints from traditionalists, as such renditions always do, but it is also cherished by everybody who likes jazz, rhythm and blues, and Marvin Gaye. There are many versions over the years. And, of course, Jimi Hendrix is a favorite of my generation at Woodstock. I think that Beyonce's version definitely stands up there in that pantheon.
All right, listeners, post to our page, in addition to all the political comments, your favorite version ever of the Star Spangled Banner at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Syndicated Chicago Tribune columnist Clarence Page, thanks a lot.
Thank you.